Hello, on this week's program we speak with pianist Long Long about his latest recording and his upcoming performance at the Kimmel Center in Philadelphia. Jason Pfeiffer visits the Interact Theatre Company and talks to artistic director Seth Rosen, the writer of the company's latest production, Reinventing Eden. We take a look at this weekend's Curtis Opera Theatre performances of Benjamin Britten's Albert Herring at the Prince Music Theatre and speak with rising star Brendan Gunnell. And in our regular exploration of the Culture File section at gophila.com, Susan Lewis explores Camden's Adventure Aquarium. That's all ahead this morning, creatively speaking.
Support for Creatively Speaking comes from the Greater Philadelphia Tourism Marketing Corporation, the Pennsylvania Council on the Arts, and the listeners of WRTI.
Long Long's latest CD, Memory, has just been released on the Deutsche Grammophon imprint. It's his first studio recording for the label and features works by Mozart, Chopin, Schumann, and on a bonus CD, lists Hungarian Rhapsody No. 2, a piece the world-renowned Chinese pianist says he's always been fond of since watching Tom the Cat perform it on the Tom and Jerry Show. Long Long performs at the Kimmel Center's Verizon Hall on Tuesday. We met earlier this week at an awards ceremony in Philadelphia. I first asked him if he was pleased with the reaction to his latest recording.
I'm quite happy with the response from the new CD. And also, this was my first studio recording. And I spent 5 days there. And I think it turns out good result. I think I really kind of get basically what I try to do on the keys, and I was looking very carefully, watching at the scores, and to make sure what I try to do it's kind of connected to the score, and yeah, it's. I mean, I'm quite happy with the result, and I think this is the best recording I done so far.
Was it an advantage or a disadvantage to be in the studio? Because when you're recording live, you get one shot, I guess, with the possibility of overdubs later. But in the studio, you have a lot more possibilities for several takes. You can, if you're not happy with a take, you can go back and do it. Was that liberating or was that constraining?
Normally, when I was younger, I don't like studio recording. I felt it's boring, and I'm afraid of microphone. But now I like it. I don't know why, but seems like it's easier than live recording because you can do so many times takes and just take the best you do. You know, you can do the if it's the first day it doesn't work, you can do the second day. Second day doesn't work, can do the third day. The third day doesn't work, can do the fourth and fifth. If not, you ask for overtime. So,
when we first spoke, as you were graduating from Curtis, it must be 3 or 4 years ago now, you talked about the fact that you had in your fingers at any time 40 concertos. Is it now the case that you're going back and simply recording all of this music that you had in your head for so many years?
I'm learning new things as well, but as you know, all those 40 concerto, I only kind of know it, but doesn't mean I play it well, you know. So I'm to relearn it and to make sure every piece gets performed. This is another thing, you learn it, but if you don't perform, then it's, you know, it's
doesn't
not
stay fresh.
It's not complete. So you know, do that, and at the same time to do new concertos. For example, I'm working with Jennifer Higdon.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah, we are doing a piano concerto next year in the National Symphony. Yeah.
Can you talk a little bit about the program you're going to be performing at the Kimmel Center in Philadelphia?
Yeah, this time I will play introducing 6 new Chinese pieces. Traditional music, which I just recorded for my next album. It's going to be released in December. And also I will play the Mozart Sonata 333, which is another one. And the Schumann Fantasy, Op. 17, which is when I came to Curtis, that was my first piece to perform. And then I will play first time in concert, Spanish Granados, Goyasques, the first one. And then also the Wagner Liebestod transcript by Liszt, which I recorded for a movie soundtrack, a classical kind of a related movie called Maestro, European production. So that is the theme. So after recording, I felt, oh, I should play this in concert as well. And one more piece is the Liszt Hungarian Rhapsody number 6. So after Tom and Jerry, let's do more.
You have noticeably throughout your career so far kept a very close ties with the traditional music of China in performances, in recordings. Is that something that's been conscious for you, or is it something that's always been natural to you, that you've always felt for this music?
My father plays that kind of music, Chinese music, and I kind of grew up in a folk musician's family, and it suits me very well because I like it very much. So therefore, I do think I have a little bit responsibility to do more, because first of all, I'm a Chinese, and I play mainly classical music. But you know, sometimes not bad to bring my culture more on the world stage. And I hope really Chinese music will eventually get one of the very important spots in the world as well, you know, as the other great, great composer, great musicians. So there's a long way to go, because it's not easy to develop Chinese piano music. It's not that easy. But I think, at least I'm starting, so hopefully you will see some kind of nice concept of what Chinese music brings to people.
Well, we look forward to hearing more of it. Thank you for speaking with us.
Thank you.
Pianist Long Long in an excerpt from Träumerei from Robert Schumann's Kinderszenen. That's featured on his latest CD, Memory. Long Long is in recital at the Kimmel Center's Verizon Hall this Tuesday at 8.
You're listening to Creatively Speaking on WRTI.
The Philadelphia region has a long list of corporations, academic institutions, and laboratories devoted to the medical sciences. This has helped make the region a major center in the international biotech industry. Perhaps it shouldn't come as a surprise, then, that a new drama written by a Philadelphia playwright wrestles with the complexities of bioethics. Creatively Speaking's Jason Pfeiffer has more on the Interact Theatre Company's latest production and its exploration of the genetic engineering debate.
Playwright and Interact Theatre artistic director Seth Rosen says his scriptwriting process always begins with a question. About 2.5 years ago, he found himself wondering how people would react if they were to discover they had been genetically manipulated before birth. The product of Rosen's ponderings is his new play, Reinventing Eden. The fictitious story involves the family of Jonas Tuttle, a geneticist who is being honored with a prestigious science award while simultaneously being investigated by government officials. They're looking into the secret and unauthorized genetic experiments he conducted some 20 years ago. The scientist's oldest son, Paul, was born with a genetically based mental disability. To avoid the same fate with their next child, Jonas and his wife, Lizzie, altered the DNA of their second son, Jason. In this scene, Jonas and Lizzie, played by Tim Moyer and Nancy Boykin, try to explain their decision to genetically intervene to their healthy and grown-up son, Jason, played by Aaron Potratz. The older disabled son, Paul, played by Matt Pfeiffer, looks on.
We couldn't know there was any genetic abnormality until well after Paul was born. When we recognized the problem, we fixed it. You gave us that opportunity.
To fix the problem?
To inhibit the offending mutation, really?
The offending mutation.
That's so simple, doesn't it?
So that's what I am? A scientific breakthrough?
What's the matter, Jason?
Nothing, buddy.
You're just a normal, healthy person.
What is Paul? Just a problem that never got fixed? A mutation?
Jason!
Silly.
Dialogue like this highlights just a few of the tough questions that surround the science of genetic engineering, which is already being used to create genetically modified foods and pharmaceutical products. To what extent should science be allowed to fix people? Do people have a duty to relieve suffering if they are able to do so through genetic engineering? How much choice should parents be given over the health and even physical traits of their children? Seth Rosen thinks these type of questions aren't being asked enough.
One of the reasons I wrote this play on this particular issue of genetic engineering on humans is that there isn't much public debate about it. This particular issue hasn't really gotten into the public because it's not as sexy and it's also a little bit more complicated.
Cloning, for instance, is an issue that tends to get more attention and capture the imagination of the public. But Art Kaplan, director of the Center for Bioethics at the University of Pennsylvania, notes that while human cloning might be a hot topic, the issues involved aren't likely to become practical problems anytime soon.
I think the ethics action is more on the engineering side. If you think about it, just copying someone so that they look like you, it really isn't going to have that much appeal. You're not going to wind up finding many people, I think, who actually understand cloning who want to do it. Why would you copy your risk of breast cancer, your risk of depression? What you want to do is fix things, repair things, make things better. And I think that's where the play takes us a little ahead of the public understanding.
After reading the script of Reinventing Eden, Kaplan says he thinks the play does a good job of laying out some of the tough issues of human genetic engineering. But what will it take for more people to seriously start sorting through the complex subject matter? Seth Rosen suspects it will probably take a high-profile event.
A lot of these kinds of issues where science or religion even affects something that we have to do doesn't come into the public until there's a specific human case that grabs our attention. Nobody in this country, or probably much of the world, was thinking about end-of-life discussions until the Terri Schiavo case. It put that issue on the table, and every family in America has probably had a conversation now at some level, whether in depth or not, about what they want or how important it is to them. And so that dialogue is now in the public psyche.
Reinventing Eden director Harriet Power agrees it will likely take something like the Terri Schiavo scenario to bring a widespread discussion of genetic engineering to the forefront.
We tend to be galvanized around an individual human drama, and we haven't had one recently. I prefer that a work of art do it.
From the experience of staging many issue-oriented dramas throughout their 18-year history, the Interact company has found that plays can indeed at least help to stimulate dialogue about topics like bioengineering. Tim Moyer, a veteran actor of the Interact, points to the post-show discussions regularly facilitated by the theater as an important part of generating thoughtful dialogue.
We learn a lot more about the play as we run the play because we have these great feedback sequences. Sometimes people are just there to hear themselves talk, but there are sometimes we get into really great discussions about the issues of the play. And we have people who let us know that they've experienced these things firsthand.
In addition to 7 post-performance talks throughout the Reinventing Eden run, the Interact Theater Company is partnering with the Center for Bioethics at the University of Pennsylvania to host a mini-conference open to the public on April 29th. The conference sessions will include experts from the science community and Reinventing Eden playwright Seth Rosen.
Creatively Speaking's Jason Pfeiffer. Reinventing Eden is at the Interact Theatre Company at 2030 Samson Street through May 7th. The latest production by Curtis Opera Theatre features a graduating student who will soon be lighting up the stages of Europe. Tenor Brendan Gonnell, a Michigan native, has been at Curtis for 4 years and has performed in many concert and staged performances. During rehearsals for the Curtis production of Ravel's L'Air Espagnol in 2003, he was noticed by Dutch director Hans Nieuwenhuis, who invited Gonnell to the Netherlands to participate in Opera Studio Nederland, an international program for young and promising opera singers. Gonnell spent the summers of 2004 and 2005 in Amsterdam, and his performances included an appearance at the Grand Hall of the famous Concertgebouw. Although Gonnell has studied much classical opera repertoire, he has shown a particular aptitude for new works and those from the 20th century. He sings the title role in this weekend's Curtis Opera Theatre production of Benjamin Britten's comic opera Albert Herring at the Prince Music Theatre. We met earlier this week at the Curtis Institute of Music. The people of the Netherlands seems to have taken you to their hearts.
It was tough in the first 2 summers. I really couldn't speak Dutch, but I could pretend. And I'd get one or two phrases in, and then they would know that I wasn't Dutch. And now, actually, I speak enough Dutch to pass by.
When you were starting out your studies and your career, indeed, here at Curtis, this is not a very typical career path. Are you happy with the way it's turned out? You're doing a lot of new work, I notice, in the Netherlands.
So far, things have been really... I've been really happy with it. I think that nobody really can figure out... Nobody can plan exactly how it goes out, so I've sort of taken it as it comes, and I have a good ear, I suppose, for newer work, for more modern things, and I think that's good for a young singer right now, because I can't do any of the standard stuff. I'm not ready to be out on the bigger name things yet, so I can do the modern work in the interim.
Is that going to pigeonhole you, do you think, in the long term?
If it does, it's not a bad pigeonhole to be in. if a new work, if a modern piece takes off, generally the first casts are the ones that are regarded for recordings, for revival productions, for royalties, things like that. So I think it's going to turn out okay.
And how has that focus on your work impacted on your studies here? Have you kept au fait with the classical works as well? Has it altered the way that you've been trained in any way?
I basically, if I'm doing a modern work, I only work on it while I'm doing the work. Any other time, I sing just loads of lead. I do as much classical romantic opera as my voice is fit to do. I'm just one of the biggest champions of Benjamin Britten's works that's, I think, out there right now. I love it. I absolutely adore the work, so that's where I spend a lot of my time. That and the German lead rep.
If we were to give you, I don't know, a crystal ball or a magic wand, where would you see yourself in 10 years?
In Europe, most likely. I make this move over in May over to Holland, and I've told my friends and family it's sort of indefinite. And so in 10 years, I'm hoping to be singing in most of the bigger houses in Europe.
Brendan Gunnell, he sings the title role in tonight's final performance of Curtis Opera Theatre's production of Benjamin Britten's comic opera Albert Herring. In this excerpt, the town's elders have come to the grocery store where Albert works to inform him that he has been selected to be the town's May King. The title comes with a stipend of £25. This scene sets the stage for the mayhem that follows and ultimately changes Albert's previously drab life. An excerpt from rehearsals for Curtis Opera Theatre's production of Benjamin Britten's comic opera Albert Herring. The Curtis Symphony Orchestra was conducted by David Hayes. Stage direction is by Chaz Raider Scheiber. The second and final performance of this production is at the Prince Music Theatre this evening at 8. Camden, New Jersey's State Aquarium closed in 2004 after 12 years of operation. It reopened a year later after extensive renovations and expansion. Now, in our regular dip into the Culture File section of GoPhila.com, creatively speaking, Susan Lewis visits Adventure Aquarium as it nears its first birthday.
If you've ever been to one, you know that a public aquarium, at its most basic level, is a big fish pond or ponds, although human-made and actually quite tricky to operate. You could think of it as a museum or gallery whose collection has come to life. A public aquarium must handle a dicey combination of electricity and all that water, both fresh and salt water, which rusts everything and eats away at metal and concrete. And for those of us who may have had trouble keeping a goldfish alive, the idea of maintaining a healthy home for sea life ranging from tiny tropical fish to 400-pound stingrays and 10-foot sharks seems quite challenging, to say the least. But it turns out that aquariums can not only keep fish and sea creatures alive, they breathe new life into struggling neighborhoods, and in recent years have become key components in urban renewal efforts, as Peggy Amsterdam, president of the Greater Philadelphia Cultural Alliance, describes.
Retail followed the Baltimore Aquarium and office space in the whole revitalization of the Inner Harbor.
Baltimore's experience awakened other cities to the value of their own waterfronts. The New Jersey State Aquarium opened in 1992 and became one of the most visited sites in the region. Plans in 2003 to develop 30 acres of Camden's waterfront property contained as a central component a $33 million renovation and expansion of the aquarium. Adventure Aquarium opened last year and is now an accredited member of the American Zoological and Aquarium Association, as explained by Executive Director Greg Charbonneau.
What that means is we uphold a certain level of standards in terms of animal care, animal welfare, animal training, financial responsibilities, but also, more importantly, education, conservation, and research.
Promoting conservation and research dovetails with the aquarium's efforts to distinguish itself as an innovator in its field.
We're the only aquarium in the world that showcases hippopotamus in our West African River experience. We're also only one of two aquariums in North America to showcase bluefin tuna. We have sea dragons. We also participate in a survival species program for African penguins. We also showcase endangered sea turtles and threatened sea turtles. So part of our mission is to showcase animals and educate our guests on the conservation of these species, conservation of their environment, and in fact, send the message that what we do here in Camden, New Jersey can affect what goes on up in the Arctic or any other place in the world.
In Adventure Aquarium, a new wing joins a renovation of the old structure, and the combined 2,000-square-foot facility, home to more than 6,000 creatures, stretches out along the Delaware River. Visitors enter through the doors facing the water, which on the day we visit is sparkling in the springtime sunshine. After picking up a map and a schedule of the day's shows, from feedings to informative talks to films in the movie theater, you can meander through hallways with individual windows into different forms of sea life, explore the renovated ocean realm, or head for the new highlighted attractions, like the African River Experience, a space where over 20 species of free-flying birds live, as the aquarium's Bill Larson describes.
We have everything from Abdim storks to lovebirds to cattle egrets. We have whistling ducks, and all of these are found on an African river.
60,000 gallons of water simulate the river. Down a slope and around the corner, we come to a viewing area where we can see underwater. Over 1,000 brightly colored fish swim along with two very large, nearly 3,000-pound female hippos, who bob and seem to dance their own underwater ballet. Jenny and Button, whom we are told you can tell apart by the length of their noses, are logical, if not typical, aquarium residents, says Director of Husbandry Denise Aston.
Most people don't think of hippopotamus in an aquarium. It's kind of a new cutting-edge idea, but they do spend 80 to 90% of their life in the water, so why not have them in an aquarium?
Through the darkened submarine setting of the Jules Verne Gallery, with portholes into the homes of Japanese giant spider crabs, eerily suspended jellyfish, and other deep-sea creatures, waits another hot, if cold-blooded, attraction. Here we find ourselves walking under, over, and through what looks like a central casting call for Jaws, the 550,000-gallon seawater home of real-life, silently gliding, toothsome sharks, as Bill Larson describes.
We have three types of sharks here. We have sandbar, sand tiger, and nurse sharks. This tunnel, which is 40 feet, is completely surrounded by water, so it's suspended. So when people walk through this tunnel, they really are in their world. And we're observing them, and they're observing us because they can see through this acrylic.
Watching and being watched in this clear tunnel feels about as intimate as some of us would want to get with a tank full of sharks. But for those 12 years old and over who want more excitement, the aquarium offers opportunities to swim with the sharks, along with seven other adventure experiences. Oh, and if you're somewhere in the middle between just watching and actually jumping into the water with sharks, there's always the exhibit over by the Ocean Realm, where you can reach out and touch smaller sharks that swim in a wading-sized pool. On our visit, we decided just to ask someone else what a shark feels like.
Rubbery.
There's lots more sea life in the building, and the exhibits also spill outdoors, where you can visit Penguin Island, or watch some seals at the seashore, at least a spot designed to mimic it. Turns out, the Jersey Shore is popular not only with Philadelphia-area humans, but with seals from up north, during the colder months of the year, according to senior biologist Michelle Pagel.
It's pretty much like how people will vacation in Florida during the wintertime. You know, it's kind of their version of a winter vacation.
Nearly 1 year after opening, Adventure Aquarium has become one of the region's most visited attractions. Officials expect that by Memorial Day weekend, 1 million visitors will have walked through its doors. And they say that the aquarium is well on its way to fulfilling its mission as a world-class aquarium and a community treasure.
WRTI's Susan Lewis. More information on Camden's Adventure Aquarium is available at the Culture File section of gofilla.com. And that's it for now. Our thanks this week to David Goldston, Jennifer Reisers and Megan Smedley. Creatively Speaking's theme music is by Bill Jolly. Our executive producer is Jack Moore, and I'm Jim Cotter.
Creatively Speaking is a production of WRTI in Philadelphia. Support for the program comes from the Greater Philadelphia Tourism Marketing Corporation, the Pennsylvania Council on the Arts, and the listeners of WRTI.